It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Chuck Anzalevich. We've long struggled to find a viable use for abandoned mine lands. Could a species of grass provide a new solution?
We've never fertilized them. We've never done anything to them other than let them grow, which again demonstrates their ability to grow on sort of marginal mine land areas.
We'll hear from the Ohio Valley Resources' Liam Niemeyer just ahead. On this West Virginia morning, I'm Chuck Anzalevich. A federal public health agency is launching a study to help evaluate Berkeley County residents' exposure to PFAS, a group of chemicals which include PFOA, or C8, which is used to make nonstick products and flame retardants. As Brittany Patterson reports, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry is seeking the public's help with the study.
Following a congressional mandate, federal researchers are launching a PFAS exposure assessment in 8 communities across the country that are near military sites. That includes Berkeley County, home to the Shepherd Field Air National Guard Base. In 2016, the city of Martinsburg shut down its Big Springs water plant after EPA testing revealed PFAS in the water at unsafe levels. Groundwater was likely contaminated by PFAS-laden firefighting foam used at the nearby base. About 24 people attended an information session Wednesday evening, hosted by the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. Agency head Patrick Bricey told the crowd he needs their help.
We hope you all become ambassadors for what we're trying to do, and that if you talk about this amongst your neighbors, and if you hear of somebody who has a letter, encourage them to participate.
To be scientifically rigorous, the study needs 395 randomly selected participants from the Berkeley County area. Letters inviting people to participate were sent out last week. Participation involves giving a urine and blood sample, as well as answering a short questionnaire about the ways participants may have been exposed to the Teflon chemicals. The researchers will also collect tap water and indoor dust samples at some homes. Brad Goodwin is coordinating the exposure assessment. He says the goal of the study is to learn more about how much PFAS residents have in their bodies and where it could have come from.
So we'll be able to look at the concentrations of PFAS in people's blood here in Berkeley County and see how those compare to people that didn't get exposed through drinking water and understand how much additional exposure there may have been.
Researchers will be in Berkeley County in late September. Rachel Rogers is an environmental health scientist and leads the agency's work on PFAS. She says the exposure assessment is the first step toward understanding more about how these chemicals might affect our health. Previous research, including from Parkersburg, has shown exposure to these chemicals at low levels is linked to some cancers and thyroid problems.
The goal of this exposure assessment is to understand how people have been exposed. We'll be doing that by measuring levels of PFAS in people's bodies, specifically in their blood and in their urine. We're not going to be asking questions about how those exposures may impact health. Those are important questions that we are looking to answer down the road, but this exposure assessment is just a first step in that direction.
Final results from all sites involved in the assessments are expected by late 2021. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson in Martinsburg.
Across Appalachian coal country, people are looking for productive ways to reuse land that was damaged by surface mining. A 2018 study found that an area roughly the size of Delaware has been mined over the years. The Ohio Valley Resources' Liam Niemeyer reports that some researchers see promise in fast-growing grass that can help restore damaged lands and maybe help both the economy and the environment.
Down bumpy back roads deep in central West Virginia, a bright green pasture opens up among the rolling hills of trees. West Virginia University professor Jeff Skousen wants to show off a type of grass that stands above the rest of the Appalachian scenery here, literally.
But you can see you can't hardly walk through this stuff. It's worse than a jungle.
He's dwarfed by this 10 feet tall, greenish-yellow grass called a giant miscanthus. Skousen and other researchers have been growing it on this former strip mine site for a decade. While other crops would struggle with the poor soil quality from past mining, giant miscanthus thrives.
We've never fertilized them. We've never done anything to them other than let them grow, which again demonstrates their ability to grow on sort of marginal mine land areas at this kind of rate. every year.
And he believes that biomass could be a solution to revitalizing mined lands and coal mining communities.
Where we could grow a crop like this, sell it to an ethanol producer or some other heating agent, and suddenly we have another sort of economy develop for an agricultural community.
And there's a lot of old mine lands throughout the Ohio Valley. A 2018 Duke University study estimated some 1.5 million acres of central Appalachian land have been impacted by surface coal mining, roughly half of that since the 1980s. Other researchers say miscanthus can also give an ecological boost to these lands.
The health of soil, plants, animals, people, and the environment is one and indivisible.
That's Ohio State University Professor Rotem Lal. He's a soil scientist who led a study growing miscanthus on a former strip mine in southeastern Ohio. He says miscanthus has a thick root system that excels at taking carbon dioxide from the air to store in the soil. That could help fight climate change. And as more carbon and other nutrients are stored each year in this degraded soil, Lowell says the soil quality could improve too.
Hopefully that soil can be also used subsequently for food crop production, corn, soybean.
Efforts to turn miscanthus into an energy source also go back a decade. Yet some past efforts have failed because of a lack of demand. And some environmental activists are skeptical about miscanthus used for biomass energy. Cassa Heron is a member of Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, a state progressive advocacy group. The organization put out a proposed clean energy plan in 2017 that excluded burning biomass in its proposal because they didn't consider it a carbon-neutral resource. Heron says while she isn't completely against the idea of miscanthus being burned as ethanol, regulating those emissions is key.
What does burning anything do to our community? And then how our regulatory agency set up on a maximum level mitigates those negative impacts to people and the environment.
Back in central West Virginia, Jeff Skousen is no stranger to the fact that burning biomass releases carbon. But for Skousen, he ultimately wants to find a use for land that coal mining has left behind.
And I just would like to see many more of these lands used in profitable ways, because I think the resource is here. Land is a permanent resource, and it's always here.
Skousen hopes this hardy grass can be that solution. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm William Niemeyer.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Chuck Anzalevich. It's 7:51. It's going to be mostly sunny today with high temperatures ranging from the mid-80s in the northern mountains to the mid-90s in the eastern panhandle. Mostly clear tonight with lows in the 60s, and tomorrow increasing cloudiness with a good chance of showers and thunderstorms by tomorrow afternoon. Highs tomorrow will be in the 80s. For Wednesday, variable cloudiness with a chance of lingering showers, and highs on Wednesday will be in the 80s as well. Support for this weather forecast is provided by Jaeger Airport, CRW, West Virginia's gateway to the world. More at jaegerairport.com. Clarksburg is seeing a resurgence in methamphetamine abuse. Officials there say that the drug is contributing to a rise in the homeless population, and it's putting strain on services. Taylor Sisk is a freelance health reporter working with 100 Days in Appalachia. He wrote about how people who provide substance abuse and homelessness services are concerned that awareness of meth's impact on the community is far lower than issues surrounding opioid abuse. Appalachia Health Coordinator Kara Lofton spoke with Taylor about his reporting.
I want to start by hearing from one of the characters in your story. It's a guy named Gary Hamrick who works at the local Day Report Center in Clarksburg.
You know, from what I'm seeing, we don't have an opioid crisis. We have a drug crisis.
Can you elaborate a little bit about what he's referring to?
Yes, I mean, as I think most of us are aware, there very definitely has been an opioid crisis, an epidemic in Appalachia and across the country. What they're seeing now in Clarksburg, though, is methamphetamines, is the return of methamphetamines. Meth was a problem in the 80s and the 90s and into the after the turn of the century, but then pretty much dissipated. But now meth is back. Obviously, there's still opioid users, but what they're seeing much more in Clarksburg is methamphetamines. And I think Gary will tell you that in the drug testing they do at his day center, the vast majority of positive tests are meth, or at least include meth.
Is this an issue particular to Clarksburg specifically, or West Virginia, or is it nationwide?
It's nationwide. The CDC indicates that deaths from involving methamphetamines have tripled across the country between 2011 and 2016. I travel Appalachia from western New York down into northern Mississippi, and just anecdotally, I'm hearing this more and more frequently, that meth is back. Meth is a bigger issue. We still have an opioid problem, but meth is becoming much more prevalent.
So let's listen to one more bite from Hamrick.
If you narrowly define a drug addiction crisis like opioids, then it's much easier at some point to declare victory.
What does he mean by that exactly?
Well, Gary is concerned that the federal government is going to one day declare victory over opioids. A lot of gains have been made. But Gary's fear is that if there no longer is a prevalence of opioids in his community, the federal government's going to pull their funding out. They're going to pull out much-needed funding for prevention and treatment for his peer recovery coaches. And he's going to have no funding, and he's still going to have a drug problem.
So let's turn to another guy you spoke to at length, someone named Lou Ortenzio. What is his story?
Well, Lou has a very interesting story. He was a family practitioner in Clarksburg. He was selected as Citizen of the Year back in the early 90s. And then the stress, he opened up a free clinic and I think overtaxed himself. And the stress of the job led him to start taking opioids. He was, as he'll admit, he was abusing opioids. And then he was overprescribing opioids. And he lost everything pretty much. He lost his family. He lost his medical license. And then he had an awakening. He found a calling through religion to work with people in recovery. And now he runs the mission in downtown Clarksburg.
And talk to me a little bit about the mission. What do they kind of do, and like what is their role in Clarksburg?
Well, I think the mission is sort of it's a safe haven. With Lou and his staff, they find empathy. They find people who have experienced addiction. A number of his staff have suffered addiction and are in recovery. And so I think it's a gathering place. It's a place where a number of recovering addicts are available for mentoring. There really is a nurturing environment there for people in recovery.
Ortenzio tells an interesting story that he says he heard from someone he met at a recovery conference. I want to listen to that real quick.
A woman who I'd met last year came up and told the story of her son who had been on opiates, but then went on methamphetamine. And when he came into a Medicaid assisted provider, the doctor said, there's no opiates in your system. Go home and use a little bit and come back on Monday and we'll get you on Suboxone. And he went home and banged fentanyl and died. She had tremendous hostility against the physician, of course, but he was following what the protocol is because you've got to have opiates in your system in order to get on Suboxone. You've got to be withdrawing in order to qualify for Suboxone according to the protocols that follow.
What is going on there? Is the recovery community too oriented toward opioids and isn't reacting quickly enough to meth? What happened?
Well, it's a complicated issue, but there is no Suboxone for methamphetamine. There is no methadone. There is no drug to withdraw from methamphetamines. What you'll hear is that it's almost to your advantage if you do have another drug in your system in addition to methamphetamine. So that you can be detoxed, so that you can then get into a recovery facility.
To kind of go back to Hamrick's fear about if the federal government declares victory against opioids, if there isn't a drug that can basically help you detox from methamphetamine, what does that mean in terms of addiction in these communities that are seeing sort of a shift in drug of choice?
As Gary told me, there's always a path forward, but there's no single path. I mean, there's no silver bullet. It requires a number of things. It requires more treatment options, more effective treatment options. It requires better coordination of services. It requires, foremost, is housing. It requires transportation. It requires vocational training. It requires all these things, and it requires the commitment of a community to get behind all these wraparound services. There is no single path.
That was Taylor Sisk with 100 Days in Appalachia speaking with Kara Lofton. You can see Taylor's reporting at 100daysinappalachia.com. Appalachia Health News is provided with support from CAMC and Marshall Health. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Chuck Anzalevich.